for argument in the case of Smith versus Executive Custom Homes, and the petitioner can proceed.
Justices, good morning. Tim Schutz with the law firm of Haynes and Schutz, appearing on behalf of Jim and Judy Smith, the petitioners and cross respondents. Let me begin by saying what a great honor and privilege it is to appear in this venue. We appreciate the court's exercise of its discretion to hear this case and to address the two important legal issues that are critical to our clients, the Smiths, but also to the residents generally of the state of Colorado. As the court knows, there are two primary issues. First, when does a claim for personal injuries begin to accrue when those injuries are caused by a construction defect? Second, should Colorado recognize the equitable repair doctrine? And if so, do the facts and the reasonable inferences from those facts in this particular case justify its application? I'm going to attempt to address each of those issues in turn, trying to save a couple minutes of my time for rebuttal. I understand that the court is very familiar with the record and the underlying facts of the case, so I won't address them in detail, except as it's just necessary to briefly frame the issues. So first, let me turn to the issue of the statute of limitations. When does a claim for personal injuries attributable to construction defects begin to accrue? The operative facts are very straightforward. A construction defect, a gutter problem that was causing water to leak onto a sidewalk, was first noticed by the Smiths at their residence in February of 2004. Ms. Smith was injured when she fell on ice that accumulated on the sidewalk about a year later in February of 2005. This suit was filed in January of 2007. If the claim for relief accrues at the time Ms. Smith suffered her injuries, the suit is timely. If the claim for relief arises when the defect was first observed, then arguably the claim is not timely.
It's a two-year statute of limitations?
That is right, Justice Hobbs.
And that 2 years parallels generally what you have in a personal injury suit, is that right?
It does. It is consistent with the general negligence statute of 2 years.
But the wrinkle here is that this construction defect is a little bit different. It's a predicate that occurs. It seems to have some kind of limitation based on the reform the General Assembly enacted. Would you explain that?
Yes. What is unique about this situation is the particular statute that applies to construction professionals, that is section 13-80-104, contains both a statute of repose and a statute of limitations. The statute of limitations is 2 years. That particular statute also contains an accrual provision. In contrast to another statute, 13-80-108, which also contains an accrual provision for personal injuries. The general statute says that a claim for personal injuries accrues when both the injury and its cause are known to the claimant. The specific statute here, 13-80-104, says that a claim for relief arises at the time the claimant discovers, or in the exercise of reasonable diligence, should have discovered the physical manifestation of a defect in the improvement, which ultimately causes the injury. So the focus under the statute is a reference to a physical manifestation of the construction defect. The trial court and the Court of Appeals construed that statute to mean that the claim for relief for personal injuries arises when the physical manifestation of the construction defect is first observed, irrespective of whether or not any personal injury has yet been suffered. And we would acknowledge that, at least at first blush, that portion of the statute, the accrual language in section 13-80-104, can be read in that manner. But we also believe that that first blush reading effectuates an irrational and unjust result, and one which we should not attribute to the legislature unless it is very clear that that was their intent, and we think it is not so clear that that's what they intended. The injustice. A couple of illustrations that we included in our brief, which I'll briefly state here. A situation may occur where there is a very minor manifestation of a very minor defect. This case is a good example, a gutter problem. Or the court can think of any other number of examples where there's a relatively minor physical manifestation of a construction defect that's not working. The property owner brings that to the attention of the contractor, and the contractor says, ignores it, or says, I'm not going to repair it. At that point, the property owner has maybe a $50, $100, $500 repair. But if he does not file a lawsuit and later is injured because of that defect, their claim may be barred before they ever suffer the injury. So the defect is noticed on January 1st, 2007. It's brought to the attention of the construction company. They refuse to fix it or decline to fix it or just ignore it. Injury is suffered 2 years later. Under the Court of Appeals interpretation of the statute, that claim for personal injuries is barred before the personal injury is ever suffered. We can...
Now, Mr. Schutz, to be fair, and I think you implied that, is that the provision is very broad, doesn't just address personal injury claims. So there are a number of claims, possibly, arguably, that could have been made, minor in nature perhaps, but once the defect was discovered. So that the injustice comes not from the fact that the claims could not have been made, but rather instead from the fact that as a practical matter, for economic reasons, probably some or maybe somebody wouldn't choose to make the claim.
Exactly right. Two aspects of Your Honor's question that I think are important to emphasize. First, the injustice is not limited only to personal injury cases. We can think of a similar example where, you know, a light switch, a relatively minor defect, is brought to the attention. A contractor chooses not to fix it or ignores it, and later, you know, 2 years later, the house burns down because that light switch actually had a short in it, and that claim too would be barred, the claim for the damage to the house. The injustice results, yes, not from the fact that there is no potential claim, but that the meaningful claim, the claim on which a suit would be brought, has not yet been suffered. In this case, the personal injury. In our hypothetical, the house burning down. So that the claim gets barred when a client is, or a homeowner, property owner, is making a decision whether or not to sue a construction company over a $100 defect or something thereabouts, and makes the rather rational decision not to file a lawsuit over something of that nature, but it later turns out to be something that is catastrophic in terms of a subsequent injury that was not suffered at the time the defect first manifests itself. The trial court and the Court of Appeals candidly wrestled with these very issues. I thought this quote from the Court of Appeals was appropriate. We agree with the homeowners that statutory interpretations should avoid absurd results, and we understand the point the homeowners are making. And the court went on to say if this court had legislative powers, it might have drafted the statute differently. However, as the trial court acknowledged, it's not for a court to interfere with the legislature's explicit determination that in all statutory construction defect cases, the need for faster resolution of claims trumps the need to wait for an injury to occur. And I think the Court of Appeals is being candid, as was the trial court, wrestling with the policy considerations and not wanting to legislate from the bench. We would suggest that part of the court's responsibility and obligation and purview is to read a statute and to give it a rational effect, if at all possible, and to construe it consistently with the legislative intent and with other statutes that are in control. When I also contrast that conclusion about rationality and irrationality and the court's limitations with a statement that this court made back in 1970 when it adopted the discovery rule for statute of limitations claims involving malpractice. The court was quoting, I think it was an Oregon case, the decision is the Owens decision. The court said, to say that a cause of action accrues to a person when she may maintain an action thereon, and at the same time that it accrues before she had knowledge of any wrong inflicted upon her, is patently inconsistent and unrealistic. She cannot maintain an action before she knows that she has one. To say to one who has been wrong, you had a remedy, but before the remedy was ascertainable to you, the law stripped you of your remedy, is to make a mockery of the law. And I think before we attribute that kind of mockery or that kind of intent to the General Assembly, that we should very critically review the statute and its history, and bear in mind some principles of statutory construction that this court has frequently repeated. That is, section 1380.104 is in derogation of the common law. The common law rule is that a claim for relief arises not only when the defect, the cause, but the injury itself is also known to the injured party. As we mentioned, a claim for personal injuries, both at common law and by statute, arise when the injury and its cause are known. The court has said on many occasions that it will not imply an intent of the General Assembly to override the common law unless that intent is expressly stated. And statutes should be construed harmoniously, both internally and with reference to other statutes. So, briefly, looking at the legislative history of Section 1380.104 and its predecessor, 1380.127. This is a statute, as the court may well be aware, has been in front of you on a number of occasions. It was originally adopted in 1969. When it was adopted, it had a 10-year statute of repose and a 2-year statute of limitations. It had no accrual provision.
Would you explain the difference between limitation and repose, please?
Yes, Your Honor. The statute of repose is a time period that bars a claim measured from an event, and an event that may or may not involve injury. And in this particular case, the statute of repose measures from the time the construction is completed. So any claim is barred within after a passage of 10 years. A statute of limitation, in contrast, traditionally requires knowledge of the injury and its cause. And in this case, there's a 2-year statute of limitations. This court construed the statute in 1978 in the Duncan-Schuster case, gave it some limitation, and it was amended then in response by the General Assembly in 1979. And it's at that time that we first see the language of when a claim for relief accrues under this particular statute. In 1979, the statute said a claim for relief under this section arises at the time the damaged party discovers the defect in the improvement which ultimately causes the injury. I'm paraphrasing there. So the language in the first iteration of the accrual statute was in reference to a damaged party, implying that the party had already been injured, had suffered some damages. Statute gets amended after this court's decision in 1984, the Criswell decision. Legislature revisits it in 1986 and eliminates that language, damaged party. But there's no suggestion that they were trying to modify the common law rule or modify when a claim for relief accrued. They changed the language in the accrual statute from a reference to damaged party to a claimant. And it's that language that the trial court and the Court of Appeals seems to be focusing on, that a claimant, a claim for relief arises at the time the claimant knew or through the exercise of reasonable diligence should have known of the physical manifestation of the defect. The emphasis on the claimant or de-emphasis of damaged party suggests, as the trial court and the Court of Appeals held, that that the focus is simply on when the physical manifestation of the defect is discovered, not when the actual damage is incurred. But I don't think that the legislative history evidences any intent to change the accrual provision that is generally applicable under Section 1380.108
and under common law. When you're referring to the legislative history, did you attempt to find out if there were any relevant tape discussions?
We did not, Your Honor. I did see there is one reference, I believe, in the Duncan-Schuster case. It may be Criswell, but there is a reference to some legislative history and some tapes. We were not able to procure them, but I think that there may be, I'm not sure it's still in existence, but at that time there's at least some reference there. So in summary, we believe that the obligation of the court, the responsibility of the court, is to construe a statute in a way that is rational and not in a manner that invokes an irrational or unjust result.
Before you leave that point, could you just go back then and wrap up with us and tell us how you would read those words then to mean what you want them to mean?
I think that that there is no express direction, no express conclusion from the General Assembly that they mean for a claim for relief for personal injuries to accrue when the physical manifestation of the defect occurs, but when no damage has been suffered. And to get there, I think we look at, number one, they did not expressly state that they intended to repeal either the common law or Section 13-80-108, which remains good law and says a claim for personal injuries accrues at the time both the defect and the injury are discovered.
Is that the 2-year statute
it
for
is.
Personal injury?
No, that is, Your Honor, the general statute that is devoted specifically to the question of when a claim for relief accrues.
Okay.
It applies not only to personal injuries, but to property damage. And I think what you can read the statute to say is that the 1380-104 preserves the common law rule that a claimant the claim for relief does not arise until the claimant is injured, claimant, that they have some injury, damaged party, as the language was in the predecessor iteration of the statute, that they have some actual injury, and that they then discover the cause of that defect. And I think that reading is consistent with...
And that reading, the ambiguity that allows for that reading is use of the term damaged party, is that it, or...?
Historically,
in terms of these words, yes.
Yes, and now the language is claimant.
Right.
And I think the ambiguity that exists is we have 1380-108 that says when a claim for relief generally arises, and we don't have an express clear statement by the General Assembly that notwithstanding Section 1380-108, when a personal injury is suffered and it relates to a construction defect, the claim for relief arises irrespective of whether or not any personal injury has been suffered. It arises when the defect is known.
Yeah, I may have said that backwards, but so in terms of the words, in effect, you're saying we could treat the term claimant as being ambiguous, and we could interpret it to mean damaged party because of past history, and that's the way to import into these words a legislative intent that they only meant this to apply to a claim by a damaged party, which couldn't occur until after the damage occurred. Is that sort of it?
That is exactly the argument, and that if... Because the other statute embodies the general common law, because it is the general statute that applies, and it is the common law principle, that we should not attribute an intention to overrule that common law unless the legislature made it very clear, and they haven't by the use of that language.
Okay, thank you.
I also think very briefly on that that what this statute contains, if it's interpreted as the trial court and the Court of Appeals has, it's really two statutes of repose. One is measured from the six-year statute of repose, it was amended down to 6 years, from the date the construction's completed. And then in the personal injury context, there's a separate two-year statute of repose that's measured from any manifestation of the defect. It really operates as a statute of repose rather than a statute of limitations because the injury upon which suit is filed is not known. And we think that internal inconsistency also justifies interpreting the statute in the manner that we urge. Let me turn to the equitable repair doctrine. We start here, I think, from a little bit more agreement among the parties. In its reply brief, the respondent stated that they agree that the repair doctrine may have a reasonable basis for application in other cases where the undisputed evidence supports the existence of the required factors. In other words, as I hear the respondent's argument, they recognize that the equitable repair doctrine should be recognized in the state of Colorado. And I would suggest that's consistent with a number of Court of Appeals cases and some dicta by this court, for example, in the Hirsch decision and in others, where the court has seemed to recognize the equitable repair doctrine, though not expressly adopting it. It is that conclusion that the equitable repair doctrine should be the law in the state of Colorado is consistent with many other jurisdictions that were cited by both parties. It seems to be a relatively unanimous ruling of the cases that the equitable repair doctrine is appropriate law. We didn't cite any, and I don't believe the respondents cited any cases in which a court considering the equitable repair doctrine said we don't think it should apply. And we also are in agreement generally on the elements of the equitable repair doctrine. One, did the defendant undertake to make repairs? Two, did the defendant expressly or implicitly, based on the surrounding circumstances, represent that the repairs would cure the defect? Did the plaintiff rely on the express or implied representations? And did the plaintiff delay in filing suit? In short, we believe that the doctrine has significant support in this jurisdiction and in others, and it should be the law of the state of Colorado that the equitable repair doctrine apply when supported by the facts. So let me turn to that to address what I think are the areas of disputed fact. And of course, as the court knows, this case was decided on summary judgment. So the familiar standards as to taking all inferences from the disputed and undisputed facts in favor of the claimant applies in this case. The defendant concedes that it did undertake repairs. But where the defendant really focuses their argument is on whether or not they made any promise to make these repairs and whether that promise was relied upon by the Smiths in terms of a delay in filing suit. In order to frame that issue adequately, I need to just briefly delve into the facts of this this case, and that is we have here a common interest community, and we had a property manager in place, which is common in a common interest community. And the facts, limited record which is developed at this point, demonstrate that it was the practice, not only for the Smiths particularly, but other property owners in the association, to notify the property manager if there was a defect.
Could you specifically zero in on what evidence there was on the record?
I can.
With respect to that?
Yes, there are a couple of things, Justice Bender.
Is there evidence that there were an agent?
Yes.
And if so, what is it?
The evidence is twofold. First, there are discovery responses from the Smiths, and I don't have the record citation here, but in the Smiths' discovery responses, they said, we were encouraged as a part of the defect process to report any defects to the property manager, ZNR management.
Who encouraged them?
I don't know that is stated expressly in the discovery responses. But in addition to that specific response as it relates to this instance, I guess my memory here is that the discovery responses also state that they had followed this practice in the past and defects had been addressed. But it wasn't just with respect to the Smiths. The record also supports that this was the process that was followed in other instances, because the defects here, these roof and gutter defects, were not just at the Smith property, apparently. There were other instances where property owners had similar defects, and the same process was followed.
Is there evidence that the Smiths were aware of the other homeowners' complaints?
No, I'm not aware of any evidence that suggests the Smiths knew of the other homeowners' complaints beforehand.
Is your argument in this point, does it turn on the fact that the property manager was the Smith's agent?
Yes, I think the property manager was actually acting as a dual agent for both the Smiths and for ZNR management, and for the construction company. There are three emails that I think frame this issue and demonstrate it, and they're cited, as I recall, in our reply brief. The Smiths learn of the defect. They send an email to ZNR, and they say there's been a sheet of ice forming on the sidewalk. I'm paraphrasing here. I feel this is a construction defect and should be repaired by or reimbursed by Executive Custom Homes, the contractor. ZNR then, within a day, turns around, sends an email to the contractor. And that email says, this is the same problem that Gary, the executive for Executive Custom Homes, already fixed at another residence, and a few others, if I'm not mistaken, going to the point of this process that was in place. Can you have the maintenance guys take a look at it? Within a day or two, the defendant, the contractor, responds to ZNR and says, we had Peakview Roofing go out and take a look at the gutter at the Smith's residence. It does need to be sealed better, but they need to wait until the snow has melted off. They will go back out there over the next week or so and make the repair. So, and goes on to say they would have notified the Smiths about this process, but they didn't have the telephone number of the Smiths. We believe that those email communications evidence a clear promise to repair. They go out, they assess the situation, the weather is not adequate to allow the repairs to be made at this point in time. They say they'll send somebody else out in the next couple of days when the weather permits to actually make the repair. All of that gets communicated back to the mutual agent, the property manager, ZNR. This is either an express promise, we think it actually supports an express promise to make the repair, or certainly an implicit promise to make the repair. The defendant next attempts to argue not only that they didn't make a promise, but that it wasn't relied upon by the Smiths. And I think that misconstrues both the intent and the purpose of the repair doctrine. This is the process that was followed. The homeowners did everything that was asked of them. They understood that the repair was being made because no one said, hey, we're not going to do this, we were refusing your demand, or you go out and do this yourself. But in addition to that, in addition to the silence by the defendant and actually what we now know to be affirmative undertaking of the obligation, that the Smiths see no further accumulation of ice or snow, and so they think the problem is cured. And so we believe the evidence, and certainly the reasonable inferences from the evidence, support a conclusion that the Smiths relied on this representation. One other point before winding up on the repair doctrine. The defendant has also made some argument or suggestion that they never made a promise that this would cure the defect, that this would cure the problem, that one of the elements of the repair doctrine is that there is a promise and a promise to repair the defect. And they're saying, well, we never made the promise that we would repair it or that this would cure the problem. Again, I suggest that that's an overstatement and a failure to recognize the real purpose of the repair doctrine. Certainly they, by their action and by their inaction, led everyone involved to believe that they were going out and fixing this problem and that the fix that they were purporting to do would be adequate. They never came back and said, for example, hey, we don't think this can be done, or we're not undertaking any responsibility for this repair.
Now, let me get to the agent point.
So yes.
How much of your argument depends on finding that the property manager is the agent for the Smiths?
Yes. And
do you have reliance if you don't have the agency?
I think I think it probably does depend on an agency relationship. I don't want to get too bogged down in terms of a traditional agent principle analysis, but it seems to me that for purposes of the real issue before the court, which is, were the need for repairs communicated to the defendant? Did the defendant receive those repairs and acknowledge its responsibility and commit to undertake those repairs? I think unquestionably ZNR was acting as the agent for both of these parties. It's the process that was followed not only in this instance, but in the other instances out at the site. There's no evidence to suggest that ZNR said, "Hey, you know, we're not going to listen to you. We're not going to follow your orders. We're not going to let you be the intermediary." To the contrary, they embraced this process and responded to ZNR.
Mr. Schutz, I want to pick at that edge that you just made. You said you don't want to get too bogged down in traditional agency relationship. Why shouldn't we use principles of agency to make that determination? And if not, what should we use in its place?
I poor word choice on my part. I think we do have to get into some kind of an agency analysis. I guess what I'm stressing is nobody has focused on that in terms of the briefing. Neither the trial court nor the Court of Appeals nor the parties have focused on defining of agency and provided you with significant citation or legal analysis on agency principles. But I think that this is a person who was utilized by both parties for purposes of receiving and communicating information concerning the making of repairs at this property, and there's no evidence to suggest the contrary. Certainly at the summary judgment standard, or at the summary judgment stage and the standards that go with it, there is sufficient evidence in the record that a juror could reasonably infer that these parties, or CNR, was acting as a mutual agent for the parties. I have about 2 minutes, and I will save that for rebuttal time. Thank you for your attention.
Good morning, Your Honors. Please, the court. Jessica Muzio, 29293 for Executive Custom Homes, the defendant, respondent, cross-petitioner in this case. Your Honors, with regard to Section 104, which is the statute that is before us, this court has, in lots of jurisprudence, stated that the primary task is to ascertain and give effect to the legislative intent of the statute by looking at the commonly accepted and understood meaning of the terms. This Section 104 has both a statute of limitations and a statute of repose, as Mr. Schmidt said. It also has a separate accrual period. And this court has recognized that in the Hirsch case, this court specifically noted the special accrual language of Section 104, and that 104 had a separate statute of limitations and accrual formula for claims against contractors.
Well, remind me, the facts of Hirsch involved fixing up a defect, or did it involve personal injury?
It didn't involve personal injury. It was fixing up a defect. But actually, in Hirsch, this court said that 104 didn't apply because there was a separate repair or replace remedy, so therefore there was a different statute of limitations that applied. But in doing so, this court noted that there was a separate accrual formula in 104 that dealt specifically with the contractor statute, as this court referenced. And so So with regard to claims against contractors for deficiencies in improvements to real property, it is Section 104, and it's a separate special accrual formula that is to apply. Now, this court's task, again, is to give effect to the legislative intent, and the legislative intent is clear and unambiguous from Section 104. Mr. Schutz's position would be that we need to somehow give an accrual period in 104 different for property damage, and you utilize Section 108's accrual period for personal injury. Well, if the legislature wanted to do that, they would absolutely have made that clear in the statute. The statute as it is, 104, does refer to a different statute with regard to the time limitations on the statute of limitations. In the very first section, it refers to Section 102 for the two-year limitations period. Instead of saying 2 years, it refers to 102. The legislature could absolutely have done that with regard to the accrual period. Instead, it gave a very clear accrual period language. All actions that claim for relief under this section, so under 104, arises at the time the claimant knew or should have known of the physical manifestations of the defect, which ultimately causes the injury. And that language is important too, because there, what the legislature is saying is, with the word ultimately, is it's recognizing that you could discover the physical manifestations of a defect, that physical injury or property damage or what it is occurs later. That is the clear and unambiguous, commonly accepted meaning of the word ultimately. This is what the legislature chose. This was their policy decision. And the Court of Appeals in this case said the statutory language is quite clear. The trial court agreed with that as well. And when the language is clear and unambiguous, there is no need, per this court's precedent, to even consider the legislative history, because it's clear and unambiguous. There's no need to resort to other statutory interpretation models or looking at the legislative history. The Court of Appeals continued by saying, in addition to the statutory language is quite clear, that a claim for relief under SDARA, the Colorado Construction Defect Action Reform Act, arises not on the date of a physical injury, but when the physical manifestations of the defect, which ultimately causes the injury, is discovered. By plain and unambiguous language, the General Assembly expressed its intent that a construction defect claim accrues when the manifestation of a defect is discovered, no sooner and no later. Mr. Schatz also quoted this language from the Court of Appeals, which is, it's not for a court to interfere with the legislature's express determination that in all construction defect cases, the need for faster resolution of claims trumps the need to wait for an injury to occur. And so it's clear, based on the facts of this case and the very clear email that came out in February of 2004 and the discovery responses whereby the plaintiffs admit to knowing of a physical manifestations or learning of physical manifestations of an alleged construction defect in February of 2004, that is what started the statute of limitations clock running. And Mr. Schutz, and there have been a lot of briefs in this case, Your Honors. I counted 16, and that's the briefs before the court and the briefs in the record. And we've argued this back and forth, Mr. Schutz and I. And the arguments coming from the plaintiffs is that this is an inequitable and absurd result. Well, the Court of Appeals and the trial court both considered that, and they determined it was not an absurd result because, as the Court of Appeals stated, and as the trial court stated, more often than not, personal injuries from construction defects are foreseeable. And it was absolutely foreseeable, the Court of Appeals said, that noticing ice accumulation on a sidewalk should put the onus on the homeowner, should trigger some responsibility to take some action because...
But let me ask you this. I mean, I guess the facts are that it did trigger that responsibility, and then they thought it was fixed. The ice accumulation went away. And maybe that goes more to the equitable repair doctrine, but factually, isn't that kind of the dilemma you're facing? They did do something, and as a result of what they did, they thought the problem went away.
Well, I understand it, and so, Your Honor, you're stating that they did do something by notifying the property management company.
Well, they thought it got fixed.
Well, and that's what
they got an email to the extent that it was going to be fixed as soon as the weather improved.
Yeah, I think Your Honor.
And then they observed that it was fixed, or at least there was no more accumulation.
Right, and I think Your Honor is right in that maybe it goes to sort of a hybrid of the statutory interpretation and the repair doctrine. And you're right, they did take some action by notifying the property management company. But then hearing no response from anyone.
Well, they did hear a response.
I'm sorry.
The response was that they're going to fix it.
No, the response was never communicated to the plaintiffs. In fact, the plaintiffs, and that's the concern that we've had with the repair doctrine in this case, is that the plaintiffs stated in their discovery responses, they never knew of any repairs. They heard no communications back from ZNR. They had no communications from ECH. They had no communications from anyone with regard to their request.
Ms. Buzio, you make the argument, we're really getting to the second issue.
Right, yeah, I am getting to the second issue.
But if you make the argument that their silence doesn't trigger the doctrine,
right.
Basically.
Yes.
And it seems to me that, I guess I don't quite understand, you know, obviously you're aware of the, you know, non-moving party is entitled to inferences. But it seems like the implied promise is a question of fact. Whether or not there's an implied promise from the circumstances, whether or not their reliance was reasonable. So if you put all that together, the facts as laid out by Mr. Schutz seems to indicate that at least there's a reasonable inference that would defeat summary judgment. So, construed in most favorable light to the plaintiff. So what's wrong with that, which I think is what the Court of Appeals said. So what's wrong with what the Court of Appeals said?
Well, yeah, the Court of Appeals... And it was confusing at first because when I first read the Court of Appeals opinion, it sounded like the repair doctrine applies to total limitations period. But then it said, Your Honor, it's correct. It said, but we think that this was not appropriately determined on summary judgment at this stage of the proceedings.
Right.
And I think that the facts that underlie consideration of whether the repair doctrine should apply, they are undisputed. We are not disputing any facts whatsoever. And
you're just arguing the inferences, right?
Well,
doesn't that raise factual issues that runs against grant of a summary judgment?
I would posit that I think.
I'm sorry.
I would posit that I think this court can, as a matter of law, determine that the repair doctrine, that there are undisputed facts here, and so we can actually grant summary judgment, not applying the repair doctrine because the three factors that specifically are required by the Court of Appeals in this state, by all of the other jurisdictions that have discussed the repair doctrine, are completely absent. And in fact, the Court of Appeals here said, if we didn't have an HOA, the Homeowners Association, then this absolutely would not be reasonable. There absolutely could be no reliance by the plaintiffs because they didn't know of any repairs. They admittedly did not know of any repairs. And so I think we can, as a matter of law, determine that the repair doctrine doesn't apply because there are undisputed facts underlying this basis. The three factors that we need to, that the court needs to find for the repair doctrine to even come into play are undisputedly not present here.
Is that true if the management company, the property company, is the agent of the Smiths? Because the ZNR had two-way conversations with the builder, and the builder assured ZNR that they were going to make the repairs.
And Your Honor, I do not agree that, not surprisingly, I'm sure, that ZNR is not the agent for the homeowners. ZNR is a property management company. The homeowners could go through ZNR. They may have been encouraged, which was their discovery responses. That's all the evidence I saw on the record. But that's belied by the fact that after Ms. Smith was injured, there were direct communications with ECH all of the time, ECH being Executive Custom Homes.
Well, does that negate the fact does that really decide the issue as to whether or not the property manager was their agent for these purposes? It wouldn't be hard to see why the Smiths might be unhappy with them as an agent and not use them in the future. But wouldn't that satisfy the repair doctrine if ZNR is the agent of the Smiths?
I don't think so, Justice Malarkey, only because the repair doctrine... And I heard Mr. Schutz say that I didn't cite any cases that said the repair doctrine was not a good doctrine. I actually did cite, it was a outside jurisdiction case, and it said, and it just didn't like the repair doctrine. But if we're going to apply it, really the repair doctrine is a particularized form of estoppel, and there needs to be reasonable reliance. And really the question is, how can a person rely on something of which they had no idea. They simply heard nothing and saw nothing.
Help me out. If ZNR is their agent, and ZNR had knowledge and reliance, that would be imputed to the Smiths, wouldn't it?
I don't know that.
No?
It's a tough question to answer, Your Honor, only because I don't think ZNR is the agent, but putting that aside and discussing your hypothetical, I think the repair doctrine, that's not enough for the repair doctrine. I think the repair doctrine still needs, it says reasonable reliance in not filing a timely lawsuit. And how is reliance reasonable when it's based on nothing? No silence, nothing. ZNR could have totally not even responded to ECH, not even had given them the request for repair, and ECH didn't. These homeowners, the point is, these homeowners knew nothing about the communications. They knew nothing about repairs. They admitted to knowing nothing about repairs. So the repair doctrine relies upon this, is based upon this reasonable reliance in not filing a timely lawsuit, having been led into not filing a timely lawsuit, not knowing anything, just putting out a request out there and then not following up on it, not hearing anything back from ZNR or from ECH.
Well, common sense would tell you that if you're in a common relationship like this, somebody else, and you go to a responsible management company and you have a responsible contractor, they're going to do it right. So, I mean, the question about agency also has to be tied with the fact that they didn't see any further manifestation. Then if we look at the statute of limitations and repose we're talking about, the whole policy of the legislature, to give it credit, is to go to the contractor through your agent or yourself personally and get a repair done. It's to deter, you know, just letting things happen. The contractor at some point needs some surety. They've done their job. You know, they're out of there. So what we have here is an incredible hardship, it seems to me, by the accumulation of these two arguments here, that there shouldn't be an equitable relief for this kind of situation when the repairs are in motion, based on a very harsh statute. And I guess I have to agree with it, based on the language of the statute, it includes personal injury. And it appears that the only rational policy is that you can't just sit when you see a defect. And we had a defect manifested here, this ice from the leaky gutters, right? But the homeowner in this kind of circumstance, it seems, did everything in a common sense fashion to start off the repair process. And your answer is, what? They didn't rely on it? They didn't rely on the chain of getting this thing done?
Yep.
I mean, they got to go up on the roof and see whether the repair is adequate?
No, I think, Your Honor, and I appreciate the question. I think, and I don't mean to be evasive by my other answers before. I think that the onus on a homeowner is to make sure that some action is taken. And as a homeowner, I don't think, and I agree that you say it's common sense, but I don't know that I would put out there and just assume that the contractor would take some repair work. I don't know that I would assume that. But here, it's not inequitable in our situation, because even after Ms. Smith fell, there was still 1 year left in the statute of limitations period within which they could have brought their lawsuit. And they did not. So here, the situation we have here, Mr. Schutz has a lot of hypotheticals, and I understand, you know, from all the briefing, that these are his hypotheticals. But in the situation that the court faces, in the situation that we have here, the email where they noticed ice accumulation was in February of 2004. The injury was in February of 2005. They still had 1 year left to the running of the limitations period based on the clear and express language of the statute within which to bring their...
Okay, I'm a little confused. Wouldn't, under the equitable repair doctrine, there's some kind of tolling, right? Wouldn't it run from the defective repair?
Yes, if the repair doctrine applied. My point was to answer your question with regard to the inequitable nature, the harsh...
Oh, the statute itself?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I was more interested in your answer, or where I thought you were going with this, was the question of whether it was reasonable for them to rely. And I understand your point is they're relying on nothing because nothing was communicated to them. However, doesn't that beg the agency question? In other words, is it reasonable for them to rely upon the communications to their property manager? So, I mean, they've essentially, I mean, I think if I understand the agency argument, they've delegated this to the property manager. Property manager will take care of it or inform them otherwise. Did not inform them otherwise. They rely upon that. The property manager, in turn, relies upon the representation from your client.
I think it's an interesting argument, and neither, and as Mr. Schutz mentioned, neither Mr. Schutz nor myself have briefed the agency argument that Your Honor has brought up, and it's a good point. I have a hard time with seeing ZNR as their agent, and maybe in this instance they relied upon ZNR to give the communication to ECH, but not hearing anything back from anyone, from ZNR, from ECH, and not knowing of any repairs, I don't think allows the plaintiffs to then rely on not filing a timely lawsuit. I think that's a subversion of the repair doctrine, and if this court's going to adopt it in Colorado, I can see cases where it could be applicable. I just don't see those cases here. I don't see that this is one of those cases, because I don't think it's reasonable. I don't think there was reliance here on silence, and I don't think reliance on silence is reasonable.
You see, that argument sounds to me like, to keep you honest, we need to file a lawsuit, because we don't really trust that the chain is going to work to get this thing actually fixed, right? So now we have to go hire a lawyer, we have to make sure we get the statute of limitations, and file this lawsuit, and what's the court going to do? Okay, so the lawsuit progresses. It turns out that it's going to, you know, they're in the progress of repairing it, or there's a defective repair. Seems to me this argument spawns litigation other than reliance on the normal human conduct that the legislature certainly has to anticipate, that good faith agents and constructors and repairers will do their job, right? Without, you know, filing another suit and paying a filing fee and initiating discovery and all the rest of this stuff.
I agree with you, Justice Hobbs. I do. I think that a step that should have been taken, not filing a lawsuit, but the step that should have been taken was, hey, ZNR, did you communicate to ECH? Hey, what's going on? Has anybody come out and done repairs? That should have been the next step. That would have told the plaintiffs, okay, they are conducting repairs. I don't see any other ice accumulation. So now I can rely upon these repairs and whatever other communications were from ECH to ZNR.
Of course, we don't have any real evidence yet because this was done on summary judgment, right?
Well, we do have all of the evidence, and respectfully, Your Honor, I think we have all of the evidence.
Testimony, what is it, proffered evidence?
It's discovery responses.
Discovery?
Responses to discovery, saying by plaintiff saying we knew of no repairs, we made the request to ZNR, we heard nothing back from ZNR, we heard nothing from ECH, we knew of no repairs. That was the discovery responses. That's the evidence that we have here, which is, it's undisputed. And hopefully that is sufficient to underlie the application of the repair doctrine, that it shouldn't be applied in this case. But here again, you know, and I understand that we're concerned with, we want to interpret the statute, but we also want to do equity. And I definitely understand that. But here, the record shows that plaintiffs are not being left without a remedy. The record shows that the plaintiffs did recover from ZNR Property Management Company and from the Homeowners Association. They recovered $30,000 from them. So we're not leaving them without a remedy. And I think that's important because I think the Court of Appeals was very concerned with making sure that some equity was done. But again, here, I don't think this is the case to apply the repair doctrine.
Excuse me.
Bless you. Every case that has applied it has had this one-on-one communication. There's been no middleman. And for the other jurisdictions that I cited to, and I know that they're not binding precedent, I thought they would be helpful because Colorado hasn't adopted the doctrine yet, but some other states have. And there are some states, some cases in Pennsylvania which has adopted the doctrine, where one case there were repairs and then promises that these repairs would cure the defect and then reasonable reliance. And the court held there, that's an Amadeo case, that the repair doctrine applied. But in A.J. Aberman, another Pennsylvania case, there were repairs, but no promises that repairs would cure the defect. No assurances to the owners that the repairs would actually work and cure the defect. And therefore, the court held we're not going to apply the repair doctrine. Even though there were repairs, of which the plaintiffs knew, there was no second step, which is required by the Court of Appeals in the Highline case, that the repairs would cure the defect. And here, we have plaintiffs not knowing of any repairs, not having any promise that repairs of which they were not aware would cure the defect, and we want to apply the repair doctrine. And that was my concern with the Court of Appeals decision. But back to the statutory interpretation argument. I think, again, that it's clear and unambiguous. We don't need to resort to legislative history. I think that the accrual period is the same, as Justice Hobbs indicated. He sees that the accrual period is the same for personal injury as for property damage. And I think, you know, when there are two statutes that could apply, 108's accrual period and 104's accrual period, the more specific statute has to apply, and that's this court's precedent as well. And the more specific statute is Section 104. And Mr. Schutz also discussed legislative history. Although I don't think we need to go into it, the legislative history also supports the interpretation of 104 by the trial court and by the Court of Appeals. SIDARA's purpose, and I say SIDARA again, it's the Construction Defect Action Reform Act. It's just a mouthful. In all construction defect cases, the need for faster resolution of claims trumps the need to wait for an injury to occur. The purpose of SIDARA was to reduce the cost of insuring construction professionals, to decrease construction defect litigation. I think that legislative history supports this interpretation. When Mr. Schutz talks about the 1979 version of Section 127, which was the predecessor to 104, he mentions damaged party, and his argument is that clearly there, the court was saying damaged party, so you're damaged before the statute runs. Well, if you look to the actual language of Section 127, it does say damaged party, and then that changed to claimant at 104, but then it again has the same exact language as what 104 has now, which is the claim for relief arises under this section at the time the damaged party discovers or in the exercise of reasonable diligence should have discovered defect in the improvement which ultimately causes the injury. Again, I go back to that ultimately term. That is clearly an express intent that you can have a discovery of the physical manifestations of the defect, but not the injury until some later date. So I don't think we need to focus on damaged party. I think it's a distinction without a difference. And as Justice Martinez had indicated in his question, that the statute is very broad, that other claims could have been made during that time period. I think, again, it's important to state that here, we don't have an absurd result because the Court of Appeals stated that it's more often than not foreseeable that injuries could occur from construction defects. And I think mostly what the Court of Appeals is saying as well in some other cases is that the injury, more often than not, occurs with the discovery of the construction defect. I think the interpretation given to Section 104 by the trial court and the Court of Appeals is the most sound interpretation to actually give effect to the legislative intent. I think that based on our courts in Colorado, what application or analysis they have given to the repair doctrine issue supports that in this case, that doctrine should not be applied on the facts that we have. As the Court of Appeals said, if we didn't have the Court of Appeals noticed that the difference between the facts that we have in this case and the facts in all the other cases that have applied the doctrine and adopted it and said if there were no homeowner association, it's certainly not reasonable to infer a promise to repair from someone who has failed to act or respond to a repair request. And I think that's the situation we need to focus on, because what the Court of Appeals is doing is treating owners within homeowner associations differently than owners outside of homeowners association. And I don't think we have an agency situation here to give them reliance. Here, I think it's important also to note that there's been no determination that there's been a construction defect. We keep mentioning construction defect, but I've always tried to call it an alleged defect. I think that's just important that we note that. Again, I think it's important to note that we haven't left plaintiffs without a remedy. And I think it's important that all of the facts with regard to the second issue are undisputed. So Executive Custom Homes would ask this court to affirm the Court of Appeals decision with regard to its interpretation of the statute as to when the claim for relief arises and what starts the statute of limitations, and reverse the Court of Appeals with regard to its decision as to the repair doctrine. I don't think it's necessary on this record to remand back to the trial court. No further evidence or discovery is necessary on this issue. Thank you, Your Honors, for your time.
I appreciate the remarks of counsel. I think on the issue of the statute of limitations, I wanted to make just a couple of brief comments. First, in response to Justice Hoff's questions, the Hirsch case was a property damage case. There is one case in which the accrual language was discussed in a personal injury case. That's the Homestake decision from the court. But in that case, the personal injury accompanied was suffered at the same time that the construction defect was discovered, tripped over a defective sprinkler, as I recall. In any event, the court has not yet addressed the issue that's in front of you now, that is whether or not the accrual language applies when the manifestation of the defect occurs before the actual personal injury. I believe counsel is correct in some of the purposes that she's enunciated for the Construction Defect Act, but one of the other purposes that is clearly stated as part of the act is to preserve adequate rights and remedies for property owners, and that should not be lost on the court. I want to turn briefly to the repair doctrine and focus on this issue of agency. I think that this is a somewhat unique case in the sense that we have a property manager. It's a common interest community. But it also, I don't think, is totally unique. Even in the private construction context or residential context, I can envision lots of cases where a construction manager is acting as the intermediary between a particular construction company or a subcontractor and the owner. And this kind of exchange of notice of a defect is made between the owner and an agent. There was a comment about some communications after the fact and that after the injury was suffered between our client and the defendant, and to suggest that disavows the agency relationship. I would simply point out that there were those communications. However, those communications related to the actual claim for relief and the claim for compensation for damages. It did not relate to any sort of remedial construction work. So the process that was followed in all instances relative to construction was to go through the intermediary. And I would just emphasize in conclusion the argument that the defendant is making really amounts to grossly inequitable situation, a situation almost of legal gotcha, where the defects are reported and then the silence is used as a basis for the running of the statute of limitations. We think the legislature did not intend that result. Thank you again for your time this morning.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank both counsel for your arguments. Case stands submitted.